From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you read about the story of Gary Gilmore, the focus is usually on the death penalty, for obvious reasons. Gilmore murdered two men in Utah in 1976, and his demand to have his death sentence actually carried out made international news. But what drew the writer and photographer Lawrence Schiller to the story was something else. Schiller says the choices that Gilmore had made along the way revealed a picture of America that most people didn't see. Schiller interviewed more than 100 people. He had thousands of pages of transcripts, but in the end, he asked Norman Mailer to write the book. The Executioner's Song became a classic in American literature. The story is also told in a film that Schiller directed, which is being screened this week, and it gives us a chance to talk to him in studio. We invite you to join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're revisiting the story of Gary Gilmore with a man really responsible for exploring the story. Now, most of you know the basics. Gilmore had been paroled in 1976 to the care of his cousin, Brenda, who lived in Provo. He only lasted a few months, maybe four, before he killed two men in Utah County. Gilmore was given the death sentence. He chose the firing squad. But what made his story remarkable was that he actually wanted to die. And no one was being executed in 1977. There had been a 10-year moratorium on capital punishment in the United States, and opponents of the death penalty were desperately fighting this case, worried, of course, that it would open the floodgates for executions, which it did when Gilmore was shot at the state prison in January. Lawrence Schiller saw something in this story, something that went beyond the argument over capital punishment. He saw a bigger story about American culture, really. So he conducted more than 100 extensive interviews, and when it came time to write a book, he asked the novelist Norman Mailer to do it. And The Executioner's Song won a Pulitzer, has become a classic in American literature. Lawrence Schiller went on to direct a film of the story, which is screening in Salt Lake City this week, which brings him here to Utah today. Let me introduce Lawrence Schiller, and it's going to take a minute. Because he's a photographer and a journalist and a film producer, his photos have appeared in Life magazine, in Look, Playboy, Glamour, the Saturday Evening Post, among many others. He's a senior advisor to the Norman Mailer Estate, president and co-founder of the Norman Mailer Center. He directed and co-produced the film I mentioned, the 1982 TV miniseries adaptation of The Executioner's Song. The Utah Film Center is screening that film in Salt Lake City, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. Lawrence Schiller, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I've come back to Utah many times over the years.
I wanted to start with that. When you first, after you did find the story, and I want you to talk a little bit about what interested you in this, but when you first came to Provo, which is where you spent a lot of time, what did you make of Provo, Utah?
Well, you have to understand that at that time, I was leaving photojournalism. I had started at a very young age, age 17, working for magazines like Life and Perry Match. And I give you a little bit of the background so you understand. And the magazines in the early 70s were going out of business because the advertising dollar was moving to television. So many photographers like myself were looking for other interests, whether they were in book publishing or film or whatever, making documentaries. And I started by making documentaries. So I started to do true life stories as television movies, first to produce and then eventually to direct. I'd already been to Utah on an earlier project that interested me, which had to do with a small group of people that were experiencing plural marriages across the board in St. George or somewhere in that area.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was an article written called Raid on Short Creek.
Yeah.
So the subject of the community was known to me. I'd already experienced as a journalist many, many stories of antisocial behavior, starting with the Charles Manson story in 69. And even before that, the Kennedy assassination in 63, Martin Luther King's assassination, Robert Kennedy's. I was present at all those events as a photojournalist. So antisocial behavior, as I phrase it, was in my mind. And I was actually working on a film which was called The Trial of Lee Harvey Oswald. Yeah. It was a fictional film as if Oswald had survived the shooting by Jack Ruby. And one day I read in the Herald Examiner, Los Angeles newspaper by Hearst, a small article based upon a story from the Deseret newspaper here that a convict who had been sentenced to die had carried out a suicide pact with a young lady who was found unconscious with two of her children in proximity to her, and that she was very young in age, even though she'd probably been run over by a lot of trucks already in her life, as the metaphor goes.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, is this a window in which to look at evil, that a man would do that so selfishly to deprive these children of a mother?
And what you mean by that is he, Gary Gilmore, really talked to this woman. Her name was Nicole Baker at the time, Barrett now, but he essentially talked her into killing herself.
Correct. She visited him on death row. Yeah. They had had a long relationship before, which was maybe the tipping point of this tragedy of Max Jensen and two Mormon missionaries being killed by him. But the short and long of it is, what interested me was this: was this a window to look into evil? Hmm. So, did Gilmore, was he a way of really exploring that?
But you see, everyone else at the time was thinking, this story is about capital punishment. This story is about
the firing.
That wasn't the thing that you were interested
no,
in.
No. I couldn't have cared less about capital punishment because I always look for the human story. What's under the veneer of the story? And then seeing that this was set in a Mormon community, and even though even today I know some things about this devout faith, which has such great assets to it, and I something triggered in my mind. I said, well, is he a Mormon or not? I didn't know he was Catholic at that time, even though his mother raised another son Mormon. I said, is he a Mormon? And, you know, if he wants to be executed, is he asking to go on to a better life in the next life? Because from my limited knowledge of the Mormon religion at that time is that when you die, you go on to a better life. When you marry for eternity into your next life. All of these things were just little facts in my mind. I wasn't anywheres really schooled on it.
Yeah.
But if you can understand those little things triggered. So now as I'm coming to Utah to seek out the journalist that broke the story. You know what I'm saying? You always look for a door that's ajar, you know. A young lady by the name of Tamara Smith Aldred.
Right. And she was a little sort of a stringer at the time. She
that's right,
it.
Sure.
She cracked that story.
Yeah. So the point, these are all the things that are going into my mind. But the minute I land here, the minute I meet Tamara, the minute I go over and start to make appointments with Gilmore's lawyers and this guy and that guy, there is something that smells different about it. There is something that it's wider. You know, you look out here even at the studio and you look at the beautiful horizon, okay? So you can imagine coming here, you know, how the settlers came, you know, coming over the pass and I even coming in the early 60s and now 70s, it's still a beautiful horizon with land still to be cultivated, societies still to find their own roots, you know, beauty that maybe is never really appreciated by those that live here. And I have to admit that I had made a very, very, very big mistake in my life with the Charles Manson story in 69 because Susan Atkins had confessed the Tate-LaBianca murders to me, which I published, and I didn't see the bigger story, you see, and I saw the smaller part of it, that confession, that story, you know.
That crime.
Exactly right. I didn't see the whole social implication of what Manson was and how you could almost be like Svengali and, you know, and Rasputin all wrapped up in one, and how these young girls, you know, who had run away from home. So the short and long of it is I was subconsciously or consciously running and looking for a story to make up for the mistake that I had made before of passing the signs on the highway.
Huh.
So Utah, I thought, was
that was going to redeem you.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
There's no question about it that, you know, I was now being given a second chance. And, you know, the minute I saw that there was a possibility, you have to understand another thing that runs parallel with this, and this may or may not be interest to your listeners, but it's very important to me. I wasn't working for a corporative structure. I've never had an employer. I wasn't working for Time Life or the New York Times or Salt Lake City Tribune or Associated Press. So I didn't have a checks and balances to my activities. I didn't have a structure. I didn't have an editor over me.
Or a deadline necessarily.
Or a deadline,
right?
Exactly right. I was a one-man band, you see. So I could do and move the way I wanted, not saying always correctly, not saying always thinking out what's going to be around the corner, because a lot of mistakes are made when you are that way at a young age,
yeah.
Because it was a young age for me. I'm 77 now. But the short and long of it is that I decided to jump in and to go into the well. I didn't care how deep the well was. I didn't care if it even had a bottom. And I decided that I was going to stay. And, of course, the first thing is how do you get to the prime person, which is Gilmore? And, you know, the story starts there.
Yeah. You know, you've talked about this investigation. I mean, I guess you just sort of camped out there, right, in Orem and in Provo?
Yeah, I moved into a motel at first. I was in the Hilton Hotel or something, and then I couldn't stand there because all the other media was there, and it was like everybody sitting at the bar at night drinking or – you know, I think that was a hotel that you could have liquor in those days, if my memory is right.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
The Grand America, you couldn't, I think, because I stayed there once. But nevertheless, and I'm not saying you should have liquor when you're working. I'm just saying.
I get it.
And the journalists were monkey see, monkey do. I mean, I had to get away from it.
Right.
I didn't want to be part of the pack, okay? So that's why I moved over to Orem, which was close to Provo, where some of the story took place.
Yeah. It's interesting when you've talked about these interviews that you've conducted, and again, you have no deadline. You have no – I guess in some way you weren't exactly sure what was going to come of it in some way. Is it a book? Is it a film? Is it – so you went and you conducted these interviews. I'm not sure how you managed to get the people that you did.
Well,
it's remarkable.
Well, you know, certainly I had an ego then, at times a bigger ego, and still have part of that ego. But the short and long of it is you ingratiate yourself to people. You make them understand that if this story has merit, they owe it to history to preserve their part of the story. And those are words that I use. And it's very, very important because we're here only for a period of time before we go into our next life, whatever that is. And how do you preserve what we are experiencing so other people can build on it positively or correct or, you know, that's what history is. That's what libraries are about. Mm-hmm. That's what education in the early days of the turns of the Stone Age, people did it verbally. They did it other ways. Now we could preserve it. In those days, you had a tape recorder. The video camera was just coming in.
Right.
The iPhone didn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, now the whole world is a journalist.
It's interesting you've said, though, that when you would interview people, you didn't come in with a list of questions.
Right.
You just sort of jumped in. You wanted it to be an organic kind of experience. Did you give yourself a time limit or you just sort of
No. Sometimes previously, even in this story and other stories, I would interview the same person for 6 months, twice a week, maybe 4 hours at a time, driving in the car. I'd put a microphone tape recorder, sometimes go shopping with them and a wireless between them and me. It was about a 12-foot range.
Gosh.
There were many different ways. I mean, even the ways of eventually interviewing Gilmore, I can explain. He was interviewed four different ways technologically. Now, you have to say, why do you do it that way? And this is very important. You see, Larry Schiller, you're hearing now slightly articulate, who has had a series of light experiences. But in those days, Larry Schiller was a kid that felt he had a very bad education, couldn't spell, couldn't read very well at all. Here is a kid who in 1963 starts to use a tape recorder talking to people because that becomes his education. He doesn't know it at that point. I mean, I would sit and talk to people for hours and hours and hours. So by the time, you know, you come into the Gilmore story, I am a skilled interviewer, but it's still my education.
Okay, so you do these extensive interviews. You thousands of pages of transcripts of these things. And at what point do you decide – it's interesting when you talk about that. So you had this kind of – I don't know if it was a lack of confidence, but you had a bit of a chip on your shoulder. You were worried about your education and you're thinking, can I write this book?
No, I can't. I can't. I've already made up my mind when I saw Tom Wolfe write Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. I already knew that I could not write. I didn't have that type of patience, whether I'm ADT or whatever. I didn't have that type of knowledge where this word used in a sentence can mean so much more.
Yeah.
Okay. I was starting to ask my first wife, how do you spell this? How do you spell that? And therefore, I would use very simple words. Even in this interview with you, you will not see me use a complex word or a word that has multi-meanings because everything is built on simplicity with me. So I already knew by then that I needed to surround myself with the most talented people if I was going to succeed in life, whether it was a good printer for my photographs, whether it was a great cinematographer for my films, or whether it was a great writer that could express not what I wanted, but a combination of what he was experiencing and what I had discovered.
I want to ask you about something that ultimately you come up with Norman Mailer. It's interesting, Joan Didion was one of the first ones you thought about, but
sure.
We can maybe come back to that. But once you decide on Norman Mailer, you've said this, and this was so interesting. You've said that what you liked about Norman Mailer was that he had stabbed his wife.
Well, I didn't like it. No.
Well, no,
I
you didn't like that fact, but you thought that that would,
exactly,
of course.
Right.
And of course, you didn't like that he stabbed his wife.
No.
But what you were interested in that fact because understand the kind of sense of rage and inclination toward violence. That
and
was
trigger,
inside,
what the triggers were for violence.
That Gary Gilmore had.
Exactly.
That was really important.
Well, I mean, was there some understanding on Mailer's part that might, as a writer, even give him a window into discovering what the triggers were in this story?
Yeah.
But that wasn't the only thing. You know, Mailer and I had already worked on two books, one having to do with urban art called The Faith of Graffiti, which I had asked him to write, and one on Maryland to go with my photographs and other photographs. But the short and long of it
is very famous photographs.
Thank you. But, you know, here was a man who had written already Armies of the Night, was a journalist more than a novelist, in my opinion. You know, people may or may not agree with me on that point. He was a man who pushed himself into the events he covered. He was part of the story. Like Larry Schiller was part of the Gilmore story when he sneaks into prison and he acquires the rights using, you know, money and things like that. So there was a lot that Mailer presented for me as an asset.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I could see that. Okay, just read Armies of the Night and you know how he could really write this book.
Yeah. It's interesting. You, I guess you had to sort of draw boundaries or come up with arrangements with – and because you talk about during that process and you have all of these – you mentioned at one point he screamed at you, stop sending me transcripts of interviews. You got to let me get this book written.
That's right.
So what was the arrangement? I guess it was a give and take. It seemed like you guys had a kind of love-hate relationship. Ultimately ended in love, but there were times when you wouldn't talk to each other for months on end,
I guess. Yeah. Well, I mean, let me say this. I'm going to reveal something here, which I have not revealed anywhere else in the world. I don't know if it's good or bad, so I'm about ready to zip my mouth. But it has But it has something to do with, to answer your question, the lies I had to tell to get to the truth.
Yeah.
That happens to be the working title of my autobiography. You see, it's kind of interesting. But so I was at that point, I'd gone through a period of life in high school where I embellished and fantasized because of my insecurities. And I had worked myself, I think, out of it in the 60s. And I had the pendulum had swung the other way. I was just a fanatic for detail and accuracy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't let anything go. I mean, if Gilmore had a tattoo on his arm, I wanted to know exactly how many inches it was from his wrist or from the shoulder blade or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to know the color of socks that were worn and all of that.
Striped socks in the book, by the
exactly
way.
Exactly right.
That must have come from you.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Every detail, you know, 16,000 pages of interviews. And people couldn't understand why I was asking for the detailing and everything, you know. Somebody was saying they were driving their car down State Street or Senza Street, and it was a this and this model. I say, well, were you holding the wheel, or did the wheel have a rubber thing on it,
yeah,
you know, that gave you better tension? Yeah. You know, I was a stickler for detail. So the short and long of it is I'm giving all of this, but to me, every time you interview somebody, you find out a new fact or a new name which leads you down another road. So I kept on going down those roads even though he started to write the book.
Yeah.
Even though he and I had already come out here and met people, even though we'd already interviewed Max Jensen and Benny Bushnell's wives, which were extraordinary interviews, and you know, to this day, the book could not have been written without those interviews.
Yeah.
So I wasn't about ready to give up, because where was something going to be found that would even make it better?
Right.
And Mailer would scream at me. There was something else. Mailer previously had always had a voice in his books. He had nurtured, he had shaped that voice. Even though I didn't read much of Mailer, you know, he forced me to read White Negro, which was one of his better pieces. He says, you've got to do that if you're going to work with me. But so the short and long of that is our arrangement was that I asked him to write the book, and it was going to be his editorial, but I had the right to review it as he was writing it to make sure it was accurate to the history, at least as I knew it.
Yeah.
So one day I get this part of the manuscript, and I'm reading about Dr. Woods, and there's a thought in Dr. Woods's mind that the writer has put in, and I know that Woods never said that to me.
Right.
And I get on the phone to Norman, and you have to remember, those days we didn't have email.
Yeah.
I don't even know if we had faxes. We may have still had telegrams. And I said, Norman, you can't put this in Dr. Woods's head. He never thought this. But are you telling me that you're editing and censoring me before I've even written the book? I already have had that. You know, Henry Miller had censorship. I'm not going to have said. I mean, I'm paraphrasing what he said.
But he was outraged.
Oh, outraged.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, you know, F and this and that and everything and hung up on me. Well, for almost 9 months, we almost only corresponded through telegrams or faxes through our wives. You know, Stephanie, my wife at that time, and Norris, who we had just married. One day, I get a communication from him, and it says, if I knew, Schiller, that I had to kiss your ass, I never would have shaved. And I went and picked up the phone, and I said, hello, lover. And we were back on
track. You're back on track.
That's not the end of the story. Oh. The story is very quick. So about a month later, he calls me up, and he says, do you mind if I call Dr. Woods and ask him if he could have thought that thought? And I said, of course you could call Dr. Woods up. You should have done that before we got in an argument. You know, and many times I was wrong. But in short, he called Dr. Woods. Dr. Woods said, you know, yeah, it's possible. And Mailer put the thought into his mind in the book.
We got to take a break. But I did want to ask you this before we get to the break. So did you have any control of the way you were portrayed in the film? I mean, you're portrayed as this hustler, as this – I mean, what did you make of that? I mean, because it was – I have to say it wasn't – I mean, it wasn't exactly an attractive portrait all the time of you.
Well, let me answer you this, and this is a very serious answer. Number one, everybody I interviewed, I told them I was going to see the warts on their face.
Yeah.
I said, please, it will be a balanced portrait, but I'm not – here, you know, to scrub you clean or to make you dirty. And there isn't anybody you'll find on my tape somewhere is phrasing it one way or another. That's what I say. So as Earl Warren said, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, you should never be guilty of the thing that you lay at other people's feet, that you yourself, you know, are responsible. So when we decide to do the book, Nicole goes into the nut house and Gary's still on death row in the story.
Yeah.
And there's no character that binds the two characters together. And originally I suggested to Norman that he interview Earl Dorius, who was the prosecutor,
right,
a wonderful guy who's no longer with us. And the short and long of it is Norman felt that there wasn't enough depth in him and so forth. So we're on an airplane from Oregon back to L.A. We've tried to see Bessie, Gary's mother, again, and no avail. And I say to Norman, and I'm going to tell you something which hasn't been in print before, but you'll find interesting. I say, Norman, you know, I think you got to use me as the character and you got to really tell the truth. And he says, why? I said, well, you know, this, I think, is going to be an important book in your life. And the fact that I've asked you to write the book, you can't whitewash me because, you know, then people will think, well, I paid money and therefore you got to make Schiller look clean and nice and good and lovable, huggable and all of this. I said, you know, you got to tell the truth. He says, are you willing to tell me the truth? I said, if you want to write about my diarrhea, you know, and my nervousness, yeah, we'll go all the way because that's what I demand of everybody else. So how can I not do it? And I said, I'm willing to take the chance like everybody else takes the chance when they sign off on my interviews. And that was it.
Lawrence Schiller is with us, instrumental, of course, in the creation of the book, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Executioner's Song by Norman Mailer. He, of course, directed and produced the TV adaptation of the film, as I mentioned earlier. And you can see that tomorrow night at the Downtown Library in Salt Lake City at 7 o'clock. The Utah Film Center is hosting that screening. Afterwards, Lawrence Schiller and others are going to be participating in a panel discussion about this story. We need to take another break. The first break. We haven't even taken one break yet. Lawrence Schiller, your stories are too good. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're revisiting the story of Gary Gilmore with Lawrence Schiller, photographer, journalist, film producer, and director. It was really his investigation that was the basis of Norman Mailer's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Executioner's Song. He also directed the film, The Executioner's Song. This was in 1982. 40 million people watched that film over the series of the two nights, and the Utah Film Center is going to be screening it at the public library in downtown Salt Lake City tomorrow night. We'll give you details about that as we go, but it's giving us an opportunity to talk to Lawrence Schiller, who's with us here in the studio. We were talking just briefly off air about Tommy Lee Jones and that performance in that film. Do you feel like you completely lucked out with Tommy Lee Jones? I mean, how did you cast him? Because he seemed such a way of conveying that story.
Well, number one, just like Joan Didion was my first thought for the author of the book, because she had written this great book called Play It Like It Lays, which had been made into a movie with Tuesday Well. Joan Didion was my first author. But then in a conversation with Norman, I discovered, you know, his views on violence based on the fact that he had stabbed his wife, committed himself to a mental hospital. He had triggers in his life. He was a boxer. You know, put a microphone in front of him. He was Art Aragon. At home, he might have been the rabbi, you know. So I had already just published an interview with Gilmore in Playboy magazine, a 19,000-word interview, a combination of all the different interviews that had been done with him by myself. And I showed that to Norman, and it kind of blew him away. And he said he wanted to meet the girl, Nicole. So I asked her to come to New York, and he played chess with her at Trader Vic's, which was at the basement of the Plaza Hotel.
And Norman Mailer played chess with Nicole Baker.
We actually went and bought a chess set so she could take it home.
Gosh.
And that's the truth. And he was teaching her chess and playing chess with her. And he found that she was very, very adapt to learning very, very quickly. And when he finished playing chess with her that afternoon, he said, I'm prepared to do the book.
Gosh.
And that was it. That's a little story nobody's ever heard.
I love that story. When you imagine Nicole, people, if you haven't seen this film or if you haven't read the book, that it's quite remarkable. Oh, okay, but back to Tommy Lee Jones.
Right. So Tommy was not my first choice. Nick Nolte was, and he said no, thank God. Tommy had just done Coal Miner's Daughter.
Yeah.
Played to Sissy Spacek, and you know, it wasn't like I was looking for a clone of Gilmore, because I don't even know what Gilmore was in his relationship physically. I'd only seen him and met him in prison after he'd been on a couple of hunger strikes. And I imagine he was 20 pounds more beefier, you know. Mm-hmm. But the short and long of it is I needed somebody who was ready to go to the edge in his own ability as an actor. Somebody who had not succeeded yet. Somebody who would take gambles as I was going to take gambles in this film. So I was introduced to Tommy Lee Jones, and we had dinner at Frankie and Johnny's in New York. And we were going to go see the theater together. This is what happens between directors and actors. This was my third film or fourth film. And we were walking down the street to go see Susie Kurtz in the Broadway play. And he said to me, well, how did Gilmore walk? And I, knowing that as a director, not trained in the theater, that I always worked with actors by giving them visual images, you know. So I said, well, how do you think a guy walks when he's been butt for 15 years in prison? And Tommy took a little jump, hop, and a skip, and he turned and he says, we're doing the film together.
Wow.
Because it was kind of like he realized that I was going to direct him, not as somebody telling him how to act, but giving him the foundation in which to build on. Now, certainly I worked meticulously with him, you know, with a script, and you know, and I tried to recreate reality, which was extraordinary in the film, because I used lots of real people in the film.
Yep.
And mixed them with actors. I mean, like Bob Moody plays himself as Gilmore's attorney, but the other actor is Ron Stanger, is played by an actor, and he jumped in the well with me, and he agreed. And it was really an incredible experience.
There are a number of moments in the film where this sense of you think that and this is a reflection of reality, so I'm not just talking about a character here, but there are moments when you get a sense, and this is conveyed in the book too, he's this lovely guy, Gary. You know, Gary's this, you know, he's this lovely guy, but then this rage emerges. This rage comes up. And there's this scene toward the end, he's in prison. And he is talking to two gentlemen, and they're asking him this question, a man by the name of Samuels. I can't remember his first name offhand.
That's the Larry Schiller character.
I was going to say, this is you. And these are the questions that you are asking, you're posing to Gary Gilmore in these last days, these difficult, difficult questions. I want to play this scene and have you talk a little bit about it.
Of course.
This is from the film, The Executioner's Song.
You speak of this cold, murderous rage you felt on each of the nights of the killings. Samuels wants to know if that rage couldn't have been vented in sex.
I don't answer questions that pertain to sex. I think they're cheap.
You seem to find it easier to talk about murder than sex.
That's your judgment. Next question.
What are some of the evil acts you could not perform?
Well, that's easy. I don't think I could torture anybody.
Isn't forcing somebody to lie down on the ground and shooting them in the back of the head torture?
It's very short torture.
How can any crime be worse than taking a life?
Well, you could alter somebody. You could maim them, blind them, fuck them up so bad the rest of their lives would be a misery. Now, to me, that's a lot worse than killing. I mean, if you kill somebody, you might be assuming their karmic debts and thereby relieve them of the burden.
So there are crimes you deem worse than murder?
I mean, Jesus, look what some governments do to their people. I'm talking about the forms of brainwash, like all the forms of behavior modification, like the irreversible forms, like lobotomies and predilection. I mean, you don't interfere with people's fate, is what I say.
Didn't you interfere with Jensen's and Bushnell's lives?
Yeah.
You think you had any right to do that?
No.
Did Jensen resist, or did he show fear?
Well, he did not resist. He did not show undue fear. In fact, I was struck by his kind and friendly, smiling face.
What that really says is it shows that he is intelligent, that this is not a dumb guy that just robbed cars and this and that and everything else.
No, he talked about karma. He talked about,
and he's talking about these things intelligently.
Right.
He's well-read in his 15 so years in prison, half his life spent in prison. And he only went in for one or two offenses, I think, if my memory's right, stealing a car and this and that. So his extended stays were always because of what happened in prison. So here's a guy who's well-read, who's almost risen to the occasion, and unknown to himself is how intelligent he is, And so this whole thing about altering somebody's life, about being maybe a greater crime, to somebody else, stayed with me for many, many years. I have to tell you, I thought about that and I thought about that. Killing somebody is really, we consider it to be the ultimate crime, and that you may have to give your own life for that. But also, and I would thought taking a hammer and putting it into somebody's head, as I know many crimes have taken place, or pouring, as the hi-fi killers did, Drano down people's throats, torturing people. And, God, that is more horrible than taking a life, because you've put them in a vegetable state. And that stayed with me for years and years.
I'm going to play another moment from the film. This is his, Gary Gilmore's statement, or at least is reflected in the film, to the Board of Pardons, the state. Because this is the question he's saying now, I want to die.
Right.
And this particular moment when he talks about how I've accepted sentences all my life, and I thought you were supposed to take them serious. You want to say something about this before you
play? Sure. This is very, very crucial on why the appeals by other groups to stay his execution based on the fact that he was insane, didn't have the mental competence. This is the key line that the justices use in their review on why they believe he is in the full knowledge and faculties and understands exactly what's going on.
I accepted the sentence that was given to me. I've accepted sentences all my life. No, I had any choice in the matter. And everybody wanted to jump up and argue with me about it. Seems that the people of the state of Utah want to have the death penalty, but they don't want any executions. When it became a reality, well, they started backing off on it. Well, I took them literal and serious when they sentenced me to death. Just like they'd sentenced me to 10 years or 30 days in the county jail or something. I thought you were supposed to take them serious. I know it was a joke. In my opinion, you're all acting like a bunch of moral cowards.
There's another incident that takes place after this, which is very, very crucial, which we filmed inside the state capitol, right where it took place, where Boaz, his attorney, turns to Gilmore in front of the entire, I believe it's the state Supreme Court, if my memory's right, and he says, are you prepared to be executed, Gilmore? And Gilmore looks at the justices and says, no, I'm not prepared to be executed today. I'm prepared to be executed on the day and the hour when the sentence has been passed for me to be executed. You see, what he said here at the Board of Pardons, combined what he says to the justices, shows that he understands what it's all about, and he's not incompetent to put these facts together and make a wise decision.
Yeah, wasn't just hyperbole. I know what it's like to die. I don't want to die, but I'm ready to die when it's supposed to happen next Monday.
Right, yeah. He doesn't know what it's like to die, and I don't mean to correct you. He knows that it's better to die in his
right
thinking than to spend the rest of his life on death row never to see the light of day again.
That's Lawrence Schiller. His film adaptation of The Executioner's Song is screening tomorrow night at the Downtown Library in Salt Lake City. He's going to be participating in a panel discussion about Gary Gilmore's story following the film. That event is hosted by the Utah Film Center. You can find more details about it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Lawrence Schiller. It was his research that Norman Mailer used in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Executioner's Song. January 16th, you had your last interview with Gary Gilmore. And you've talked about this, how there was something that you had to know. Now, mind you, this he's going to die that next day.
Well, we believe he will die. They're still going to...
Sure, it's still very much up in the air, of course.
It's being challenged.
It's possible that he could die that next day. So it's very close to this particular time. And you've written about there was something you needed to know, but you didn't want to just talk on any ordinary... in an ordinary hotel room. You went into a closet of the motel room in which you were staying in Orem, because you've said you needed to focus. You said you had to get a sense that you were in that same room with him.
Right. The thing, is I interviewed him four different ways. One-on-one, face-to-face. Two, by writing questions on large sheets of paper, typing them actually, and then he would write the answers. His lawyers interviewing him with questions that I gave him and tape recording them secretly, like I tape recorded mine secretly. And then eventually the warden allowed him to have phone calls with his advisors, not with journalists.
Yeah.
So I wind up on those phone calls. And the one subject that he always ran away from was the subject of his mother. And that was the subject of this phone call, because with hours only left, and even though I was eventually to witness the execution the next day, I didn't know at that moment I would, because I was on the invite list, but I didn't know if the warden would approve me being a journalist, because journalists in those days weren't allowed. So I wanted to be in the same room with Gilmore. I just dying to be in the same room. That's totally impossible. So I put myself in the closet and dragged the phone on the long cord in and closed the lights and sat there in the darkness and talked to him and tried to place myself looking into the darkness as if I was looking into his eyes.
He didn't give you very much about his mother, did he?
No, he didn't give me very much about his mother. He refused to. To me, why his mother? Why is this journalist, whatever I was, chasing him about his mother? Well, God, if he's going to be executed, his mother's up in Portland, Oregon. I don't care how sick the goddamn mother is. Why has she not come down to try to talk her son out of being executed? This is what was going crazy in my mind. And I could talk to Bessie for hours and hours on the phone, which I did. Michael Gilmore even talks about it in his own book, about how I gave him all the tapes and he learned so much about his mother.
That's a terrific book too, by the way.
Shot in the Heart. It's just an extraordinary book. So, I just did my best. And, of course, you don't succeed always.
It's what's extraordinary, the scene in the book and in the film, when you compare it to how orchestrated these executions are today. The execution, which you witnessed, of Gary Gilmore in 1977 in the cannery building of the prison there at the point of the mountain, it was wide open. There weren't any separate rooms with walled off with two-way glass. You were there, and you even were able to approach him as he's sitting there in that chair where he's going to be shot. And people were able to sort of have a word with him, and you did. Give us a sense of that scene and that the last thing you said to Gary.
Well, let me say this quickly. I felt that the whole execution was like a military operation, but it was so absurd. Number one, you have to understand what took place the night before while they're waiting to see whether the Supreme Court thing is going to be overturned or not. There's almost a party on death row. I mean, they bring in food. There's a record player. People are dancing.
Yeah, he's dancing.
He's dancing. And the guards are laughing and joking with him. And the other inmates from death row weren't allowed in the room. But he could invite anybody he wanted, his uncle, his relatives, his aunt, you know, his lawyers. And, you know, he's playing around. So there was a festivity because, you see, Gilmore by then was in partnership with the state. He wanted to die. The state wanted him to die. It's only those on the outside, the NAACP, the ACLU, all these other people that say if you open up the floodgates with Gilmore after the 10-year moratorium, look what's going to happen in Texas and look what's going to happen in Florida, which it did.
It did.
But now you go to the next day to the execution, and I'm informed something like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning that the warden has agreed to let me because Gilmore invited me as one of his 5 people. His uncle, his 2 lawyers, myself, and Nicole. Nicole couldn't come because she was incarcerated in a hospital.
Right.
So, yes, I go not knowing what it's going to be. And I didn't know Gilmore was going to ask to speak to me while he's sitting in the chair that he's going to be shot. I didn't know the warden would even allow that, you know. And, you know, he asks his uncle to come talk to him. He asks his lawyers to come talk to me. It was an extraordinary situation. And, you know, I went up to him and he said, wanted to talk to me. And I didn't even know what to say. I said, Gary, I don't even know why I'm here.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you're here to help me escape, something to that effect, if my memory is right. You have to remember, I haven't read the book in 30 years.
No, that's what he said.
Something to that effect.
Yeah.
And then I went back, and as I was putting cotton in my hair, you know, the anonymous shooters from behind a cloth screen that had little cracks in it, you know, the warden reads them, and Gilmore looks up and quietly says, you know, let's do it. And then Father Mearsman, who plays himself in the film, comes to give him his last rites or whatever. And Gilmore responds in Latin. I mean, it just blew me away. And he and the priest, you know, as if have this 4 words and 5 words in Latin. I mean, it's out of a great dramatist, you know. But yet, you see, Gilmore was raised a Catholic. His brother was raised a Mormon. You see, so there's a naturalness there. It all comes home. And, of course, all of that detailing, being able to preserve it is what, you know, makes this a true life novel. Now, a question you haven't asked me is why does the book have the word novel on it? It's very, very interesting because that's how meticulous Mailer is. If I knew or he knew something that took place at 10 o'clock and we knew something that took place at 12 o'clock, but we had to write about something at 11 o'clock and we had no knowledge of it. So we extrapolated from the information from before and after. That's the novel part of it.
Right.
So there are parts of the story that have been extrapolated.
We've got about a few minutes left. Let me ask you this. Nicole Barrett plays such a role in this story, of course. There's this moment in the book where his uncle, Gary's uncle, has this tape that Gary had recorded for Nicole on the last night, and he tells you that he had listened to it. And then he pauses, and you say, how bad is it? And he says, well, it asks her to kill herself.
Right. Selfish guy, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, worse than selfish. Even at the last moment, he won't share. And he's not thinking of her kids. He's not thinking of anybody himself. Is that being a narcissist or something? My vocabulary is not
narcissist.
That good.
Yeah, narcissist, you got it right. Yeah.
I mean, this is the ultimate. It's the ultimate. You know, I still can't perceive it, you know.
Did you like him?
Well, there's always something lovable about somebody. But, you know, as I put in the film, which is not something Gilmore said, if evil is on one end and you know, and good and righteousness is on the other, he's closer to evil than he is on the other side. So, yes, there are always things in somebody that make them human. You know, they've been raised a certain way. There are certain values they do have. But in the end result, I wouldn't want to look him in the eye if he didn't like me, because he might stick a shiv right under my armpit, and I would never even have known he was raising his hand.
1 minute left. I wanted to ask about Nicole finally. You're still in contact with her.
I see her periodically when she travels. She lives in the Oregon area. She has children from another relationship. She's got adopted children. She's got grandchildren. You know, she's found a level to her life, and that's the good thing of it. It's an experience that obviously will never leave her, and she might not agree with the majority of that book, but then she might agree that the book is even too kind to Gary in some ways.
But that you stay in contact with her, I find.
Oh, with
everybody.
Everybody from all my stories, all my projects. Because if you embellish yourself, not embellish, ingratiate yourself into the people's lives, it's horrible just to then forget them forever. It's their choice whether they want to stay in contact with me.
Lawrence Schiller, photographer, journalist, film producer, and director. He was instrumental in the production of Norman Mailer's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Executioner's Song. Also co-founder and president of the Norman Mailer Center, senior advisor to the Norman Mailer Estate. His film adaptation of The Executioner's Song is screening tomorrow night at the Downtown Library in Salt Lake City. And he's going to be there to participate in a panel discussion after the film. You can find all of those details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. That event is hosted by the Utah Film Center. Lawrence Schiller, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been interesting. Someday we'll do the second hour.
Absolutely. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.